You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, Health, Welfare, and Regulatory Affairs Liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you're listening to the special monthly American Horse Council episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for October 2025. Good morning, Horse World.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
Well, hello, everyone, and I'm so delighted to welcome Emily back from maternity leave.
Hi, all. Happy to be back.
We are so glad you are back. You were definitely missed. And what a perfect day to jump back in, because we're talking about something really magical, horse-drawn carriage rides. And they feel like stepping into a living storybook. There's just something timeless and enchanting about what it makes that experience stay with you.
And, you know, since it's coming up on spooky season, I think we should make sure we include hay rides in this conversation. I have some really special memories of picking pumpkins and going for that horse-drawn hay ride down at the local farm.
Yes, and there are just so many special things about horse-drawn carriages. First off, there's that romantic nostalgia kind of thing where you're bundled up with somebody special, or you're just soaking in the little clip-clop of the hooves. But it's all that old world charm that you just can't get enough of, and you really can't get when you're just sitting in traffic.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, compared to sitting in traffic, there's also this scenic kind of serenity. You're not rushing to get anywhere. You're just gliding through, you know, the twinkling city lights or the historic streets, or, you know, down that kind of peaceful country lane. Or in my, you know, case, up in the Great White North, that winter sleigh ride that's just magical.
Oh, I can go on and on, because I had the most fantastic sleigh ride when I lived in Vermont. It was outstanding, but I've done a lot of carriage rides in a lot of different cities. So it's one of the few times when I think you're totally present in the moment when you're in a carriage ride. And then, of course, there's that fairy tale sort of vibe to it. It's not hard to feel sort of like royalty, or like you've stepped into some kind of classic movie. The carriage, the horse, the gentle rhythm, it's all pretty dreamy.
Yes. And, you know, there's kind of that like seasonal magic, you know, around the holidays with all the festive decorations and the cozy blankets and the sparkling lights. It just kind of takes the whole experience up a notch.
Absolutely. And finally, there's that important part that I enjoy, which is the connection to history. In places like Charleston or Gettysburg, those rides aren't just beautiful, they bring history to life in such a personal way. It's no wonder people say carriage rides are unforgettable. They're romantic, they're serene, they're magical, they're historical, all rolled into one. And it's not just transportation. It's a mood, it's a memory, it's a moment suspended in time. So we are so excited today to have Tommy Doyle of Palmetto Carriages in Charleston, South Carolina, and Ben Spickett of Royal Carriages in New Orleans, Louisiana. The episode today is brought to us by one of our fantastic sponsors, which is Zoetis. Have you scheduled your horse's annual vaccinations? It's that time of year. Ask your veterinarian about Core EQ Innovator or Fluvac Innovator EHV4N1. When paired together, these two vaccines help provide comprehensive coverage against all five core equine diseases and trusted respiratory disease protection. Visit ZoetisEquine.com or follow @ZoetisEquine on Instagram and Facebook for horse healthcare tips and resources.
Today, I am very happy to introduce Tommy Doyle of Palmetto Carriages in Charleston, South Carolina, and Ben Spate of Royal Carriages in New Orleans, Louisiana. So welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, we're so happy to have you both. You both have a long history in the carriage business. So tell us a little about that. I know you guys are both real storytellers, so keep it brief. So Tommy, how long have you been doing this, and how did you get into it?
You know, I was born into it. I'm a second generation operator. My dad came to Charleston from New Jersey to go to the Citadel in 1966. Graduated in 70. I came along soon thereafter. He kind of bummed around looking for a job, sold shoes at Sears, bartended, all of a sudden saw an ad for a carriage driver in downtown Charleston and went to apply for the job, got the job. His first day on the job was my fifth birthday on November 20th, 1976. My grandmother was supposed to babysit. She flaked out. And so he brought me to work with him and told the boss it was a twofer. And kind of the rest is history from there. You know, I worked here, was on the front seat of the carriage with him as a kid through middle school, worked here through high school, and I'm going to start 35 years full time in January. So it's the only job I've ever had. I still work with my, took over the operations from him, I guess a little over 20 years ago. And I work now with both of my sisters. He still occasionally comes around and a bunch of other employees, but I was born into a very unconventional. I grew up in a neighborhood just outside of Charleston, and I enjoyed the animal aspect of it. And about 20 years ago or so, I moved to a little bit more rural part of Charleston County. I was able to start having animals of my own. And that was that's the part of the business that I find probably the most gratifying. The short answer, Julie, is I was born into it. I had no choice.
That's a fantastic story. And One quick note there. I think you said your birthday is November the 20th.
Mm-hmm.
That's my birthday too. So
we'll
talk somewhere offline about that. So Ben, tell us your story. How did you get started in all this?
I'm a little bit different route. I'm also from South Carolina. Grew up in a little town called Batesburg, Leesville. You know, grew up on a little farm on a dirt road and studied animal science at Clemson. I had ridden horses my whole life, but had not really done anything at Clemson. I met a trainer there and started riding horses and helping him train as an assistant. And I trained cow horses, reining cow horses and rope horses for the most part, along with some pleasure horses and some ranch stuff. And then, you know, I wanted to go to vet school. It didn't work out, and was traveling on a job kind of in between things. Cause when you go to pre-vet and then you don't get a job there and you don't go back to a family farm, it's like, what do you do? And I was looking for my place and, you know, went to a bunch of different trainers and ended up over in France for a little while. But after I got back and decided I wasn't going to train horses full time, I was in sales and did it on the side and accidentally ended up just traveling through New Orleans, met my now wife, ended up in New Orleans, and had always had the ability to do something else along, you know, do horses along with other things. And after about a year of being in management in the city, I was introduced to a lady at Royal Carriages. You know, my dad always kind of joked when I moved down here, he's like, I know it's a lot of asphalt, but you love to tell stories and you're good with an animal. So if you were to decide to do something with carriages, you might could do that. And that's how I ended up taking a job with Royal as a driver. Now, again, I mean, I have a background in training horses at this point in horsemanship, and also had my own driving horses privately growing up, starting at about 16, but had never done anything on a professional level with driving horses, and drove for them for a year and then took over as director, which made sense for my role, because in barns, I had been in that management role. I'd been the one that made sure that our feed programs were what they were supposed to, and our training protocols were where they were supposed to be. So it made sense for me to go from a driver to director. And then after that, ended up becoming part of Carriage Operators of North America. And so at this point, I started with them in 2017, so took over as director in 2018. So I'm 8 years there in June, and then 7 years as director in August. But my dad also went to the Citadel, so that's one thing that Tommy and I definitely share.
Hey, so I'll tell you a quick side story, Ben. My first serious boyfriend in college was from Batesburg, South Carolina, and he went to Clemson. And I'm not going to hold that against you, but. Bad combination for me there. Okay, Emily, you're up.
I'm sure I know who that person is, because my town is about 4,500 people, so you know pretty much everybody.
I'm feeling very outnumbered as the only Yankee on the call now. We all talk about kind of the joyful aspects of being with horses, but, you know, I have this really kind of nostalgic vision of going down a beautiful stroll in a carriage. And, you know, I've always wanted to go to someplace like Mackinac Island, but I know as a horse person that this carriage driving is not this romantic career. There's the early hours and the feeding and the mucking and the grooming and preparing the carriages and repairing the tack and then the financials and the ticket sales and the customers, and it goes on and on and on. So we know there's all these hard parts to it, but I'll start with you, Ben. What's kind of the most joyful part of your job? What really gets you up in the morning going for it?
I still train full time. So I train drivers full time as well as mules full time. And that's what we use in New Orleans, is we use mules. And so, and then after that, I train horses. I train riding horses when I get off work. So my day is immersed in training. If I wasn't this, I'd be a coach somewhere. I've always been that person. I like to watch that elevation. I like to set goals. You know, when it's going to a show, it's a little different. You have to go and set that goal. It's a little different in a commercial sense, but, you know, setting goals as far as where I want an animal to be, you know, and everybody has different training protocols. Tommy gets a lot more stuff that he doesn't really have to work with a whole lot. It's already ready to go. I get a lot more that I have to do more hands-on with. So it's a lot more time consuming. And of course that we're just all set up differently. So yeah, me being able to watch a mule that I got in, for instance, right now, one I got in from Mississippi, guy did some wagon trains and stuff on her, but watching her go from the first couple of days, not really being sure of me. And now we kind of got this little relationship going, and eventually I will introduce her to one of our more advanced drivers and allow her to work with them after I have done some work on the street with her, because usually I work with her privately and then I give tours and then we go from there. So that elevation, and I hate to say this, but I enjoy it more with the animal than I do with the human. We have these lovely words that can literally telepath what I'm thinking through my mouth to your ears, and you know what I'm thinking. And horses and mules don't have that. So it's a time when can be anxious, you know, sometimes stand up and walk around when I'm on the phone a lot of times. But when I'm with my animal, I have to be settled. But yeah, watching them move along, it's just like watching kids, grow up and learn and pass through. So yeah, that part of my job is what I enjoy the most, is watching that advancement.
No, I love that. And I think that speaks to a lot of horse people out there. And I would say, horses, Julie, I bet we could get him and Dr. McLean talking mules for hours. We won't be able to stop you guys. So Tommy, go ahead. Tell us, what keeps you in it?
For one, I don't know how to do anything else. And that's probably what keeps me in it mostly, but not mostly. I'm joking. Now, I genuinely love the business. I'm fortunate. I get up. I'm super lucky. I get to come someplace that I want to come every day. And it's, I enjoy the animals. I enjoy the people. Emily, you were talking about the nostalgia going down the street or in a carriage, or Julie, you mentioned going to cobblestone street. I had a fantastic experience where we were doing a photo shoot and the sun came up. So I left our barn around 5 a.m. and it was a horse. This horse is actually his last trip. And it was one of those moments. The streets of Charleston were deserted. The gas lamps, cruising down the street. And it's somebody who's been on been part of this my whole life. That was arguably one of the more moving moments, as going down the streets, the Charleston Harbor with Fort Sumter in the background to set up for, just a fantastic picture. And, the connection with that horse in particular, he was one that I bought as a 2-year-old, and last turn there was at 25. That he, worked with me that whole time.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow.
The business for me is super personal. The connection with my family, with the animals, one of the fond memories I have is the thousands and thousands and thousands of miles laid across the front seat of a pickup while my dad was looking for horses or going here or going there. And I have similar experiences with my kids. I love the connection of you know, the way my business is set up, every customer comes into the barn and to get on the carriage. And I have that luxury just from where the location of my barn is, in the middle of downtown, in the middle of everything. So every customer that rides one of my carriages, the experience starts in the barn. So the interaction that I can have with the customers, with the kids, to tell them about the animals, to let them see the animals, is second to none. So much so that I do a free tour every Saturday morning, and it's a behind the scenes tour where we take people in, we show them the animals, show them what to do, and give them a curry comb to brush the animals out into an interactive experience with the animals. Now, you know, I get tremendous joy. And like I said, that was a moving experience with Milhouse for the photo shoot. But I love the part of the business I love the most is to facilitate somebody being able to be with a horse, to see a horse, to touch a horse. And, you know, my whole model, again, is built around that interaction. And that's that, you know, what keeps me coming back is that interaction.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, you've set up for the next question for sure. So you're talking about being in the barn, and I've been in the barns at several carriage operations, and I'm always amazed at the lengths that you guys go to take care of your horses. And I know that there are people out there that think some of the horses are overworked or they lead a sad existence, but these are your partners, just as you described, Tommy. I know how much you guys love these horses and how much they mean to you. I see how you care for them. So tell folks a little bit about the rules and the regulations and all the things that you do to ensure their well-being. And before somebody goes on social media and they take me to task about this, I fully admit that everyone doesn't see the sector of the industry the same way that I might. And I appreciate that and I respect that. Yet I want you to hear these guys out. So I think the question I have is, Tommy, talk a minute about all the links you go to and what are some of the misconceptions that people have and how do you respond to people who express frustration or concerns? And what have you seen change over the years? Just give me that full picture there.
Yeah, you know, it has changed a lot over the years. You know, as a kid or when I was younger, when I would drive carriage, you know, used to get we call them, you know, a drive-by activist that would scream at us when we would go by. But it's becoming more and more prevalent, you know, and I think with, you know, obviously the internet and all the social media sites, you know, I just try to take, I stay focused on what I do. You know, there's, if people that want to have a rational conversation or have genuine concern, we will, you know, my staff is educated. I've got a staff of 22 barn hands, and we've got anywhere from 3 to 5 that are on every shift that know my business inside and out. I'm here 6 days a week to help educate people as well. And, you know, people that have already decided that what I do is bad, or they just completely disagree with it and don't think I should be in business, I can't really do much with those. But the people that are genuinely concerned and generally want to learn, I think we've sort of set it up pretty good. You know, I told you about the business model that I have. It's really one of transparency. And it came about because of people's concern. You know, you're worried about the horses. Where do they live? What do you take care of? You know, how do you take care of them? Well, guess what? Come and see. It's open. And other than being that transparent, I'm not sure what else we can do. You know, we do little things when you walk into the barn. We've got the 20 most asked questions concerned about this horse. We have a staff member at the front door to talk to customers that come in and try to leave it open and transparent. You know, Charleston's super unique. We have arguably probably the most comprehensive animal welfare ordinance anywhere in the country. Charleston has a city staffer that is an equine manager, and this person's one job is to interact with carriage operators in our barn, checking on animals, and committed to their welfare. There's no other city to my knowledge, and she's here all the time. She's in and out of our facility daily. Charleston, I mean, we're one of the few cities in the country. As hot as it gets here, we take the animal's body temperature after every single tour. You know, a lot of people, they don't realize, you know, New York City, they leave the barn and they're gone for 9 hours. In Charleston here, my barn's downtown. Our carriages do 1 hour. They come back to the barn and they get a 15 to 30 minute rest between tours where they're under mister fans and they have 15 minutes of access to water should they want it. Our animals see a vet 3 times a year. They get a health certificate twice from my vet. The city has a third party vet that comes in and inspects the animals on top of that. You know, as far as, you know, what people say about it. You know, you work them until they pass out. You know, they're limited to their workday. My stock last year averaged 5 hours a day. They had 16 weeks off. A lot of people don't think that they get out of downtown. Where I live, they live with me. We have a 30-acre farm. We've got trucks that run back and forth daily. We've got a special chute that we're required to use here in the city, help with cushioning, walking on the concrete all of the time. You know, those are just a few things. But the short answer is there's a lot of people that have already made their mind up, and I don't waste my time with those. But the ones that are genuinely interested, you know, we're welcome, and I've got nothing to hide and very transparent.
Tommy, tell me, how many horses total do you have? What breeds do you have? Average age? What's some demographics about your herd?
Yeah, so, you know, I was a mule man like Ben, but we sort of phased out of those about 7 or 8 years ago. But we feed about 35 right now. And I've got every mix and model. You know, the work that we ask him to do specifically here, and I would assume in New Orleans as well, Charleston's very flat. And so there's no hills. And so the hardest part of the job for the animal is to start and stop the carriage. The minimum weight for a horse to work in Charleston to pull one of our carriages is 1,850 pounds. That's three times their body weight is what the veterinarians are okay with them pulling here. Again, on flat ground, ball bearing wheels.
So and that's set by the city, that weight?
Yeah, it was set by the city several years ago, and it was a group that did include carriage operators, but the ultimate decision was made by veterinarians. That was an accepted weight. And we've been very successful at that, tremendously successful. But as far as the breed, I'm not super particular because the work is not that difficult. We've had the most luck with Belgians. We do have a couple of Percherons. We've had some paint horses. Again, I'm not super particular about the breed as much as, you know, are they acclimated to work in the city? The one breed that I do stay away from are the Clydesdales. I just don't think their bodies and as hairy as they are suited to work in this climate.
Yeah, but that other makes than sense that, for how warm it is. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. But other than that, I'm really not super picky. And as far as age, I really don't like much less than 10 years old. You know, I need something that's sort of been there, done that. And, you know, I talked about Milhouse, who was 25. Again, you know, we started him at, I guess I bought him at 2. We started him around 3, and a good worming program, a good feed program, a good shoeing program. And, you know, they're the Easter bunny. They'll go forever and ever and ever. Yeah. So that's pretty much the animal end of things right there.
Interesting. Okay. Ben, tell us a little bit about what you do in your part of the country.
I'll start by saying that Charleston does have the premier, like when you look at how they do things, not take away from Palmetto, not to take away from them, but like as a city in general, they do a good job and are on the forefront of what is current industry standard. So, you know, I'll say that first. We use mules and not horses. Generally, our mules, the weight for the city is lower than I believe it should be. It's about 1,000 pounds. My average mule probably is going to be about 1,400, 1,350, which we've found to do well. Now, we use two different size carriages and do not carry as many passengers as they do in Charleston. So it's a little different. But yeah, so we use mules. And that's been by ordinance since 1980. You know, we've changed some things over the years, but during the, you know, if they take an hour tour, we generally give them a 30-minute break. Now, in the cooler times of year, they have to have at least a 15-minute break, and that depends on the animal, as a per-animal basis. You know, when the temperature gets too hot, we go by ambient air temperature as well as the heat index. So if it's either 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 105 heat index, and that 105 heat index would have come into play in 2018 as a newly promulgated rule into the the Ground Transportation Bureau in this particular wording being in the animal drawn portion of the Ground Transportation Bureau's ordinance for the city. And basically they changed that to add a 105 heat index to it. As an equine professional that's dealt with animals and kind of seen the lengths or, you know, the depths in which we can travel with some of these animals and how far they can go and how, you know, how tough they are, that 95 and 105, I feel like has been pretty healthy for us. I mean, obviously if we have any animal in distress, we would pull them off the street immediately, but the 105, a lot of times here, it'll be 89 and 105. That's the way we do it. Generally give them 60 days off at a time and cycle them in and out. We have, and again, our program is a little bit different than Palmetto's. With retirees and everything, we have probably about 55 mules total. So, you know, that's everybody total. And we have 33 stalls in the city. So we cycle in and out as we need to. But yeah, so ordinance in the city is you can't use, you know, you can't use horses basically during the summer months, except for after a certain, like, I think it's 5 or 6 p.m. So we just went to mules completely. You know, during the winter months, they have to have at least a 15-minute break in between rides. During the summer months, they have 30 in between every ride. They all go back to the square. And when they're brought back to the square, if they are showing any issues or seem to be hot, we will then put them underwater and get them cold. And we have misters at the front and back of our square for us to do that with.
Tommy, talk about, you know, we talked about the welfare questions. Talk about the drivers and what are the requirements for hiring drivers or grooms or other staff that help you around?
You know,
the
that's hiring is challenging. You know, it's no different in my business than probably most. You know, I've got an extremely diverse group. You know, as when it comes to my drivers, I've got three lawyers that got tired of it, that drive carriage for me. Got a college professor that works at one barn shift a week and goes and visits Ben on her off time to drive mules down there in New Orleans. A retired financier that had a show on CNN for a long time that lives in Charleston. A master gardener, a guy that's a doctor. This is doctor a doctorate for the oboe. And I guess that didn't pan out so well. So he's drives carriage.
So we got into horses. Lucrative choice.
Yeah. You know, I've got a teen mentor program that I do over the summertime where I have three teens that work in the barn. I give them access to a paycheck and messing with the animals. But, you know, I've done it long enough to know that it's different personalities. People come to it for a lot of different reasons. Some want history. Some want to be able to work with animals every day. Some need a paycheck. Some don't need a paycheck. It's all makes and models. So I'm not going to sit here and say exactly. I know exactly what it is. But we've got a 6 to 8 week training program that starts off in the classroom that goes over to, you know, basic horse care to driving a carriage with no customers to eventually driving for another driver, to eventually going solo. Like I said, usually takes 6 to 8 weeks, some a little longer, some a little less. In Charleston, they have a tour guide exam that I require. It's not required by the city, but they require that within a year of hire that all of my tour guides become city certified tour guides. You know, Ben touched on it a little bit. I'm not an animal trainer. I'm an animal tuner. You know, if we get animals that, the ones that I get are, we can harness. They've been driven on the road. And we run them through about anywhere from an 80 to 150 hour course, the animals now here in Charleston, and see if it's a good fit for them. Again, it's not a hard job, but they got to have a noggin to work in the city. And so you take that animal and then you take the personalities that want to try to drive carriage and to try to mesh it together. I've got one lead trainer and then I've got two or three guys that work with the drivers and the other staff. Individually, but you know, it's a wide array. You know, the youngest carriage driver that's out there soloing today for me is 19, and the oldest just turned 75. And then we've got every make and model in between. So the carriage driving is a unique lifestyle. Emily, I think you touched on the hard work. You know, the glamour and the easy part is when you go out the barn and you got your customers and you're driving, but all the hard work that went to get it to that point is not appealing to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we can all feel that in all aspects of the industry.
Yeah.
Ben, what about you? Are there specific requirements you have for your drivers or your staff?
Again, a little bit different than Tommy in New Orleans. I mean, in Charleston. So since I've taken over, I've developed a training program that's a little different. They used to get not a whole lot of time. It's actually kind of crazy, but we've changed that. Originally, I allowed drivers to ride with new drivers to ride with other drivers, and I would pay a driver trainee type deal. I found that you got too many people learning bad habits, and so we had to kind of change some things up. So every person that goes through Rural Carriages goes through me first. So I interview, and it's like Tommy said, you know, you think you, and people ask this question all the time, you think you get a lot of equine people, but we're in a city. Most equine people live on dirt. I kind of joke, and I say this all often, you know, I grew up on a dirt road. I have lived on asphalt as well as on grass. And so when you look at it, a lot of equine people don't want to live in the city. I got here, as I joke all the time, by accident. I would have laughed at you 15 years ago if you'd told me I would have ended up training mules in New Orleans. I would have laughed. Nobody could come up with anything crazier than that. So, yeah, you know, going through with them, they have to be licensed as a tour guide to go on the street. Like, there has to be a licensed tour guide in the carriage for them to be able to operate. We also do a carriage permit. And the way that works is basically think of a CDL, like federal background check, drug screen, all that stuff. So they have to pass those things through the city of New Orleans, basically to prove that they're not going to be a liability to the city of New Orleans. The tour guide test is something that we, just like Tommy, helped develop. It's kind of funny. Some of the higher ups complain now, but they're the ones that put it in place just because it is a lot to get them through. You know, obviously anytime you have to go through a city government, it takes a long time with some things and permitting, you know, used to be in person. Now we do everything over the internet. It's all done, you know, through scanning documents over. They literally only go into City Hall to take their test. This is one thing I will say we do really well. We have an online training program. So basically you go in and do modules. It teaches you everything from how to pass a test to all the different stories to routes that, you know, how to dress your mule and questions about that. So I'm able to put them through that module. And of course, at any point during their working time here, they can use that system. But they go through that Royal University and then they go through me. And same thing with Tommy. You know, they start off with, you know, how to pull a mule out of the stall, how to brush, you know, how to do all these things, understanding warning signs. If they go to walk into their stall and their mule's laying down and he hadn't eaten any feed, you know, come get in touch with somebody immediately. Those little things, you know, what does colic look like? What does severe dehydration look like? So, you know, go through those things and then, you know, explaining how all the gear works, why we do things the way we do, and then going through the process as far as teaching them how to, because with us, Tommy, they have a group. I'm pretty sure this is correct. Tommy has barn staff that actually puts everything together. With our people, they pull their mule out, they put their, you know, clean their mule, put their gear on and hitch to a carriage with help, of course. But as far as getting their mule out and taking care of everything, they do all that on their own.
This has been a great conversation and we're going to get a little short on time. So I'm going to do two things. I'm going to tell the listeners that there are a lot of economic benefits for a carriage operation and a community. Charleston, New Orleans, whatever city you're in and you're running a carriage operation, you're generating hospitality dollars, you're generating all kinds of income, you're providing jobs, lots of pluses there. If you want to learn more about that, contact me at the American Horse Council and I can tell you more about that. But to wrap up this episode, the question that Emily and I have always wanted to know is, what's one of the strangest or the funniest things that have happened on a tour, Tommy? And I'm certain you've got lots of funny stories, but just pick one.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'm going to tell you two great things. Number one, well, not great things. Number one was terrible. I did a marriage proposal and the gal didn't say yes. It was a 30-minute ride back to the barn. And let me tell you what, he was not too happy. And yeah, it was a quiet 30-minute ride. So that was no fun. But I'll tell you, in all the years I've done it, I had probably one of the best experiences last April. It was a crappy day here in Charleston, and April's a big month for us. I mean, that's when we're raking hay. It was raining. My sister and I were standing at the front of the barn, kind of just looking. Two little kids come running in the barn, just like it happens all the time. They want to come see the animals. So I stop the kids and get ready to take the show them. In behind walks their father, who's Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of England, showed up in my barn to bring his kids to take a look at the horses, and then ended up taking a carriage. So that was one of the coolest things that would happen. I've given Jim Carrey, Kevin Costner a tour, both of them. So that was super cool. But it's been a great life to me.
That's fantastic. Okay, guys. Well, we so appreciate your time today. Emily and I feel like we could probably do a whole second episode just to talk to you guys about some other things we'd love to share with folks. But thank you so much for coming today. And folks, you will find their contact information in the show notes when the episode comes out. And we encourage you to check them out. And if you have questions about where all there are carriages and carriage operations across the country, look out Carriage Operations of North America, or CONA, and you can find lots and lots of locations where you can go take a carriage ride in all kinds of different beautiful settings. So thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so our legislative and regulatory update is brought to us today by Piranha, one brand with several effective insect control solutions, a longtime favorite. You can keep your home, your horse, your yard, your barn, and your pets free from pests with Piranha's sprays and misting systems. And now you can keep your home, barn, kennels, livestock areas, and more free from stink with their line of odor management products. So Piranha, try it. It works. So everyone, our legislative and regulatory update. I am confident that you've heard us mention, but we already are getting excited about the 2028 LA Olympics. In that light, today's ledge and regulatory update, we're zooming in and zooming out for a global topic on biosecurity. You've probably heard the phrase high health, high performance floating around in the equestrian circles. But if you're not from the equestrian community, what does that actually mean, and who does it apply to, Emily?
Yeah, it sounds kind of like a tagline, right? But it's actually a really important concept in the horse world. And high health, high performance, or HHP for short, is a risk-based approach to managing the international movement of competition horses. So basically, it's about making sure that when what we call elite horses, so like FEI level horses or really high level race horses, travel across international borders for competitions, that they don't bring any unwanted hitchhikers or infectious diseases along for the ride.
Yeah, exactly. And this isn't just some random idea. It's endorsed by the World Organization for Animal Health, or WOA. And the whole thing is built around strict biosecurity, health monitoring, and disease control measures.
And we think of it as this kind of world-class plan that helps keep horses safe while still allowing them to globetrot to all these big events. And most importantly, the American Horse Council has been pushing for, we'll say, decades to get the USDA to frame U.S. regulations more in line with the high health, high performance. And there's some really clear benefits to doing that.
Right. So let's break that down a minute. First, we're getting enhanced biosecurity. Horses would go through rigorous health monitoring and safety checks, which lowers the risk of spreading diseases. Horses already go through standard import health inspections, but high health, high performance health inspections really up the ante a bit and standardizes them across countries, so everyone is following the same exact protocols and we're all on the same page.
Yeah, and that's really the key point, getting everybody on the same page, right? So the U.S. is kind of doing its own little thing. It's in line, but not as much as we would like. So in that vein, this really streamlines the import process. If the U.S. adopts these internationally recognized standards, it can really cut down on quarantine times, which also reduce costs for owners and competitors. And the cost and time associated with quarantine can be a huge barrier for competitors. It really starts to rack up, particularly those coming from developing countries. We want to make sure everyone has a fair chance when we're talking about global events like the Olympics and the Pan American Games. Horse showing is really expensive enough as it is, so we want to do what we can to kind of reduce those expenses.
Absolutely. All countries should have a chance to compete, and cost is that big factor that we're talking about when we're shipping horses internationally. Related to that, if we followed high health, high performance, and enhanced biosecurity and streamlined these processes, that sets us for this third benefit, which is international recognition. Aligning with the high health, high performance shows leadership in equine health and builds trust with global partners.
So, kind of in general, countries will be more willing and excited to compete in the U.S. if we get on board with the standards adopted globally. This kind of accumulates in our final benefit of taking on high health, high performance. And that, as Julie loves to talk about, is the economic advantages. So making it easier for high performance horses to come here helps the breeding and the training and the competition sectors thrive. And I know you love focusing on the economic benefits, Julie.
Yeah, you got me there. So the easier we make it for international competitors to come to the U.S., the more intense our competition will be, the more exciting our competitions will be for spectators and for the horse industry overall. It just elevates everything. Competition is 30% of our industry, with racing being another 30%. So both of those sectors rely heavily on international competition and competitors who travel to the U.S. And not only does making sure that their horses can easily compete in the U.S. make competitions more exciting, but with them comes an entire entourage that spends significant dollars here and increases spectators and enthusiast participation.
And I just wanted to kind of like make this relatable for everyone. So I remember being a kid and in my bunk beds, you know, on the underside of the top bunk, I had ripped out all these pages from, you know, my magazines like Horse Illustrated and all that. And I had taped them up. And so along with my U.S. greats like Karen and David O'Connor and my Kimberly Severson, my BZ Madden, I also had Pippa Funnel and Lucinda Green and Philip Dutton and Pessoa. And we want to make sure our homegrown horse kids have their own posters of these great international competitors to inspire them. And to do that, we need them to come to the U.S. and compete.
So, Emily, what is the regulatory ask then that we have? So everybody that's listening knows what we are asking.
So the big ask is to help us keep kind of hounding on USDA APHIS to get on board with continuing to update the U.S. import regulations to kind of be within the high health, high performance guidelines for these competitors. We're slowly but surely chipping away at them, but now with the Olympics coming up, we have a really hard deadline that we want to make sure we're at by game time. And I know we keep focusing on the Olympics, but it's important to remember that in getting to the Olympics, these competitors also need to qualify. And that means a lot of competition, both in the U.S. and globally, which means a lot of travel leading up to the big show.
Yeah, the American Horse Council is going to keep advocating on this. And because aligning with high health, high performance isn't just about making travel easier, it's also about protecting the horses, strengthening our international partnerships. And at the end of the day, that means healthier horses, smoother travel, and stronger U.S. equine industry. Thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more numbers and links in our show notes. We invite you to support our beloved industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter, also a magazine of your choice. We have several options there. All of this to share the latest in all our legislative happenings, federal and state, as well as much more information for horse owners like you that just need to be in the know.
And you can follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast's RSS feed. You can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
Thanks for listening. And as we always like to say, we are #HereForHorses.